Good day, and welcome to the President's Commission Law Enforcement and Administration of Justice Conference Call. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Director Phil Keith. Please go ahead.
Thank you, and good afternoon. Thank you for joining us today. I'd like to call the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and Administration of Justice to order. On behalf of Attorney General Barr, thank you for joining us today for this important commission teleconference meeting. As I said last week, we're all facing challenges beyond our experience, and each day it seems like the number of infections and deaths are growing. I think we're all particularly concerned about the increased exposure to our law enforcement professionals. Unlike us on the call today, they can't stay at home, they can't telework, and they can't social distance. As I said earlier this week, they're in the eye of the storm, and I know all the commissioners share my concern as we keep the brave men and women of law enforcement in our thoughts and prayers. And to the commissioners, Vice Chairman Sullivan, and I certainly want to express our appreciation for your continued willingness and understanding as we navigate the challenges for conducting the important work of this commission. At this time, I ask the Executive Director, Dean Cooter, to conduct our roll call of commissioners.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And before I call the roll, I'd just like to remind everyone once again that today's call is open to the press. And for any members of the media who are on the call, if you have any questions or need clarifications, please contact Christina Master-Pasqua in the Justice Department's Office of Public Affairs. And now for roll call, Commissioner Bowditch. Commissioner Clemens.
Present.
Commissioner Evans.
Here.
Commissioner Frazier.
Present.
Commissioner Galtieri. Commissioner Hawkins.
Present.
Commissioner Lombardo. Commissioner McDonald.
Present.
Commissioner Moody.
Present.
Commissioner Parr.
Present.
Commissioner Price. Commissioner Ramsey. Commissioner Rausch.
I'm here.
Commissioner Samaniego. Commissioner Smallwood.
Here.
Vice Chair Sullivan.
Here.
And Commissioner Washington.
Here.
Mr. Chairman, that concludes the roll call.
Thank you, and we have a quorum. Any other announcements, Dean?
No, sir, we're good to go.
Thank you. Our focus this week continues to be on social problems impacting public safety, and today we'll be hearing from key leaders regarding substance abuse. All the commissioners should have received the agenda, bios, and written testimony of today's panelists. Thank you, and now for our panel today. We'll be modifying our program slightly as Sheriff Tugin needs to leave the call at 3 o'clock at the break time. After he concludes his testimony, we'll move to the question and answer portion, and then we'll take a break. Commissioners are encouraged to make notes for questions during the panelist presentation, and then we'll hold all questions until the panelists have provided their testimony. Without question, we will move now to our first panelist. We're honored to have Carson Fox, who is the CEO of the National Association of Drug Court Professionals. Mr. Fox, we thank you for joining us today, and you're recognized.
Thank you. Chairman Keith, Vice Chair Sullivan, and distinguished members of the Commission, I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Carson Fox, and I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the National Association of Drug Court Professionals. NADCP is the membership, training, and advocacy organization for the over 4,000 treatment courts across the United States, including, but not limited to, adult, juvenile, DWI, and veterans treatment courts. I commend the Commission for your leadership in tackling the critical issue of substance use, and I stand ready to offer whatever ongoing support you deem necessary. Today, I'll talk with you about the crucial role law enforcement plays in the success of treatment courts around the nation. As we all know, law enforcement is on the front lines of this nation's addiction epidemic, and therefore, to solve the crisis, the role of law enforcement is paramount. This includes the ongoing support and partnerships with law enforcement in implementing and supporting proven solutions. There may be no better example of this than treatment courts, where law enforcement works side by side with other criminal justice and public health professionals to ensure individuals before the courts with substance use disorders are held accountable while receiving treatment and other services to get their lives back on track. In many communities where treatment courts thrive, it is the support of law enforcement that makes the key difference. I'm grateful and honored that members of this commission are making just that difference, supporting treatment courts in your communities and across the nation. In one example, I recently spoke with Kate Rodriguez, the manager of the successful Pinellas County, Florida treatment court program, who told me of all the wonderful support of Commissioner Sheriff Robert Gualtieri, including his commitment to recovery, the community, and veterans. She said, and I quote, "We wouldn't be able to do what we do without him." The impact of this support cannot be understated. Research shows that the involvement of law enforcement on a treatment court team is associated with an 88% reduction in recidivism relative to courts that do not have law enforcement representation. When preparing to speak with you today, I wanted to tell you a story of a graduate, but given the thousands of graduate stories I've witnessed and read, I struggled to choose one that best demonstrated the symbiosis between law enforcement, treatment courts, and the community. I decided to tell you about a young man who entered the Charleston, South Carolina drug court in 2012. This young man was struggling with addiction, and he broke into a home in a quiet suburban neighborhood outside of Charleston. Ironically, he later discovered the home belonged to none other than the Charleston Chief of Police. The young man was arrested, and when it was determined he had a substance use disorder, he was given the opportunity to participate in drug court. This treatment court program has a long history of law enforcement support, and the chief followed the young man's progress as he participated in intense substance use treatment and was subjected to close supervision and strict accountability. With help from the program, the young man got a job. Instead of sitting in jail, costing taxpayers money, he became a contributing member of society. A little over a year later, on his graduation day, the chief was in court to congratulate him. The young man surprised the chief by handing him a restitution check for over $1,100 to cover the damages from the break-in. This young man represents just one of thousands of treatment court graduates, and his story represents just one of thousands of examples of law enforcement's role in strengthening the justice system's response to addiction and crime. The National Association of Drug Court Professionals has always been staunchly supportive of law enforcement. At our core, we are a membership organization representing and working with practitioners, and our board of directors mirrors those professionals, including leaders in law enforcement. Past board members include former Algonquin, Illinois Police Chief Russell Lane and former National Narcotics Officers Association Coalition President Ron Brooks. Georgetown, Kentucky's Police Chief Mike Bossy currently sits on the board. In fact, Chief Bossy read an article about law enforcement's role in his local treatment court, and NADCP included that article as an attachment to the written testimony we provided to the commission before today's hearing. NADCP is committed to ensuring law enforcement have the necessary training to be critical members of the treatment court team. With support from the Bureau of Justice Assistance, last year we worked with law enforcement officers to develop and pilot test a new curriculum to train law enforcement on the fundamentals of treatment courts, crisis intervention, building community linkages, and understanding and addressing secondary trauma. Once the COVID-19 pandemic subsides, we look forward to working with DJA and piloting this new and exciting curricula. There are no easy solutions to the problems of drug addiction and related crime, but with the strong leadership of this commission and with law enforcement across the nation committed to ensuring public safety and implementing effective alternatives such as treatment courts, I know we are positioned to make our greatest impact. Therefore, my recommendation for the commission is straightforward. Continue to encourage law enforcement to be active members of their treatment court and work closely with the treatment court teams to ensure the target population is served, and encourage at the national level the continued education on treatment court best practices so that all treatment courts follow the research to achieve the best possible outcomes and recognize the invaluable contribution and partnership law enforcement plays in the success of these programs. I would be remiss if I didn't give Vice Chair Sullivan a shout out. Last summer, she brought down the house at the NADCP conference when the 6,000 attendees learned that the director of OJP was one of their own, a former treatment court judge. Thank you, Vice Chair Sullivan. On behalf of the NADCP staff and board of directors and of the 4,000 treatment courts nationwide, I appreciate the opportunity to address the commission today and welcome any questions you may have. And finally, in these unprecedented times, I want to thank all of you and all law enforcement across the nation for the work that you're doing nationally and in your communities.
Thank you, Mr. Fox, for your valued testimony. Now we'll hear from Director Michael Cena. He is the director of the Northern California High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area. Director Cena, thank you for joining us today. You're now recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Madam Vice Chair, and members of the Commission. Really appreciate your invitation today to talk to you about this issue and the ongoing challenges to protect the public related to substance abuse. The HIDA program itself was established within the Office, Executive Office of the President under the Office of National Drug Control Policy, and we operate under the great leadership of ONDCP Director Jim Carroll and National HIDA Director Shannon Kelly. And the HIDA program with 29 HIDA regions across the country cover all 50 states and two U.S. territories. The purpose of the program was to carry out activities to address specific drug threats in those areas and to reduce drug trafficking and drug production in the United States as a whole. And to do that, we have over 21,300 full-time task force officers around the nation. 70% of those come from the state, local, and tribal participants. And the efforts that we do across the nation has the impact of reducing the number of folks out there that are on the street moving narcotics. It also helps with efforts to increase prevention efforts. And in some areas of the country, also works in that third leg that we have, supporting the treatment efforts in certain areas. That balanced approach that we have of federal, state, local, tribal participation is a keystone and one of the most important reasons that we are in that neutral position in the Office of National Drug Control Policy so that we represent all agencies across the nation with federal guidance and local regional control through local executive boards. That effort that we do is to help provide reliable law enforcement intelligence, support coordinated law enforcement strategies, and to maximize the use of available resources. Now, our nation has struggled with addiction and substance abuse since narcotics first came to America. We have moved from the opium dens that we had right here in San Francisco, where I operate, in the 19th century, but we've moved to the open-air street drug markets of today. We're living in an age where extremely addictive and deadly narcotics are available across our nation. The violence and quality of life crimes that accompany the sale and use of narcotics impact all of us. The recommendations that I have are that reforms to the criminal justice system should reflect a balanced perspective, be informed by science and fact, and have public safety as a fundamental aim. Secondly, drug courts that help individuals with substance use disorder by providing them with access to treatment must have the ability to separate the individual from the environment that perpetuates their addiction and cycle of crime. And third, that public safety community needs, they need real-time information sharing to identify overdose threats and reduce the loss of life. And our Washington-Baltimore HIDA, under the leadership of Director Tom Carr, has developed the Overdose Detection Mapping Application Program known as ODMAP. and we need to expand that across the nation. In a growing number of American communities, law enforcement is not only challenged by the crimes and victimization associated with substance abuse, but by the criminal justice system itself, unfortunately. Some prosecutors are making decisions to not file charges for violations of selected sections of the law that elected representatives enacted in their jurisdictions. Some states are reducing or eliminating penalties for committing crime, and some communities are focused on reducing jail and prison populations with little regard for the consequences. In some parts of America, there are no major consequences related to criminal behavior, including the distribution of highly addictive and even deadly narcotics. These developments are troubling to those of us in public safety who must deal with the real consequences. Stating that crime is going down because officers are not arresting those that violate the law or because prosecutors are not filing charges against defendants with the court may reduce crime statistically, but does not make any of our communities any safer. The Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, National Survey on Drug and Health for 2018, which is the most recent numbers, found that one out of five people aged 12 and older used illicit drugs in the past year. The survey also found that approximately 20.3 million people aged 12 or older had a substance use disorder related to their use of alcohol or illicit drugs in the past year, including 14.8 million people who had an alcohol use disorder and 8.1 million people who had an illicit drug use disorder. Several states have changed charging and sentencing guidelines, resulting in misdemeanor charges instead of felony charges. This has decreased our ability to connect justice-involved people with treatment services. The drug court's ability to provide resources to those convicted of illicit narcotics-related charges has eroded. Law enforcement's ability to develop sources of information has also been hampered, as minimal to no jail or prison time results in fewer defendants choosing to cooperate and identify drug dealers and those engaged in serious criminal activity. Even though many addicts know that their next dose of drugs may be laced with fentanyl that will most likely kill them, they still take the drugs because feeding their addiction is so powerful that it overrides any rational decision-making. Narcotics dealers also have little fear and knowingly sell potentially lethal drugs to their victims. This has resulted in 46,802 opioid-related overdose deaths being reported in 2018. The Washington-Baltimore HIDAs developed an overdose detection mapping tool. That OD map tool provides free suspected overdose surveillance data across jurisdictions to support public safety and public health efforts to mobilize an immediate response to a sudden increase or spike in overdose events. OD map needs to be adopted nationwide and requires support of the president to encourage every law enforcement, public safety, and public health agency in America to participate in the program. Last month, I had a meeting with my HIDA task force commanders throughout my region, and we brought together a number of individuals that are addicted to drugs. They're dealing with it and have for most of their lives, and they spent a large portion of their lives fighting that addiction and dealing with the consequences of their abuse. They also spent a considerable amount of their time incarcerated. During our conversation with them, I asked them, what changed their lives for the better? What were their greatest concerns about addiction in the criminal justice system? And I was told that going to prison and commitment to treatment saved their lives. That the greatest fear was of those folks that have lived that life of addiction and will continue to live it was that the youth of today won't have the same opportunities to be taken out of that life and get the treatment that they need and break that cycle of addiction. We should not make changes to the criminal justice system with a broad brush. Law enforcement should also not be responsible for solving all the social problems of today, but they must be allowed to have the tools they need to reduce the impacts of substance abuse that are exacerbating social problems across the country. I understand that incarceration alone is not the solution, but too many lives are lost every day because we can't get people into the treatment they need. Drug courts need to be empowered to help individuals with substance abuse disorder to receive the treatment that they need. The cycle of addiction often leads to a life of crime, homelessness, and in some cases, it also aggravates mental health issues as well. In 2018, drugs caused 67,367 reported deaths in our country. We must promote successful programs that provide real-time overdose information sharing to address this lethal threat. And these tools can also be used for dealing with and understanding the impacts of COVID-19. HIDA Overdose Detection Mapping Program, that application, that OD map, must be expanded as much as we possibly can. And we also need to be able to push that information through the use of public health analysts, drug intelligence officers, and prevention initiatives across our country. I want to thank the Commission for this opportunity to discuss some best practices, lessons learned, challenges, and successful programs that the HIDAs and our partners are using to address and enhance law enforcement and the administration of justice. Thank you very much, Mr. Commissioner and members of the Commission.
Thank you, Director Sena, for your informative testimony. Just for the record, we have two commissioners have joined the call, Commissioners Price and Lombardo. Now on to Sheriff Contugin. Just as a reminder, we'll move to Q&A after the sheriff and then proceed to a 15-minute break. Sheriff Contugin, thank you for joining us today, and thank you for your leadership with Major County Sheriffs of America and your service to our country. You're recognized, Sheriff.
Thank you very much, Chairman Keith, Vice Chairwoman Sullivan, all the commissioners, I'm sure, much like myself. This was a really great idea. We were eager to spend a lot of time doing this, never knowing what would hit us just some weeks ago. I feel this as the chairman of the Reentry Commission along with their Commissioner Sullivan. So I thank you very much for your service because I know it is not easy to put aside this time or your attention in this way. I'm the sheriff of Middlesex County in Massachusetts. I have been so for 9 years. I'm also the elected president of the Massachusetts Sheriff's Association, as well as the elected president of the Major County Sheriffs of America. I'm a former prosecutor. I'm a former state legislator where I chaired the Committee on Health Care and created and chaired the OxyContin Commission, the first of its kind that took place in the year 2005 here in Massachusetts. The opioid epidemic is one of the most pressing public policy issues confronting the United States today. Far-reaching impacts for individuals, families, neighborhoods, communities, and all levels of government. This is a public health and a public safety issue, and the intersection of these communities present systemic challenges, but also presents opportunities for holistic policymaking. The Middlesex Sheriff's Office has applied a systems thinking approach in our opioid-related work. At the core of this effort is medication-assisted treatment, or MAT. The scope of the opioid problem in Massachusetts has been vast. We are the most populous county in the state, largest in New England, 23rd most in the United States, 54 cities and towns with over 1.6 million residents. And I say this only so that we can understand the differences between each county. We also have dense urban centers, affluent suburbs, rural communities, and 25 colleges and universities. It's also important to note that in Massachusetts we have no county government at all, meaning no county tracking, no county health care, no county funding. We have been in the epicenter for a long time here in Massachusetts of the opioid epidemic. And in, for the Middlesex Sheriff's Office, we knew we needed to act and act quickly. We decided whatever we would do would have a robust behavioral health focus and be a part of a continuum of care that extends beyond the period of incarceration, all of which is grounded in data and informed by performance metrics. Our population showed great need. Just over 40% require, of all new admissions, require a medical detox at admission. 70 to 80% of those have co-occurring mental health diagnoses. Many have been mired in the criminal justice system for years, and many have been exposed to inadequate community-based systems and care. Their stories prove a disconcerting fact that jails have become the de facto treatment centers for those with mental health issues in substance use disorder. And it's unconscionable to think that incarceration is arguably the easiest and sometimes only access point to dependable care, but that is sadly the case. Sometimes it is actually, to my mind, it is the only place where individuals have a constitutional right to health care. Now, I'm proud of the programs we run at the Middlesex Sheriff's Office and many across the country, but no one should have to come to jail to get good treatment. They should be able to do that out in the community so they never have to come to our facility. But while they do, we will provide cutting-edge programs and first-class treatment within our facility. And incarceration provides a unique window of opportunity. You can't leave voluntarily. You're away from the bad influences and the community stressors, and you have access to professionals 7 days a week. We also know reentry is our window of greatest risk. 120 times more likely than the general population to experience an opioid overdose. And the likelihood of death within the first month of release is 6 times higher than any other post-incarceration period. When considering these risks and understanding the historical experiences of individuals, we knew that we had a responsibility to provide this treatment. And so we began the Medication-Assisted Treatment and Directed Opioid Recovery Program, or Matador. What we call Matador 1.0 began in 2012. It was an on-site MIT program that was offered to inmates in the form of extended-release injectable naltrexone prior to their discharge. This is also known as Vivitrol. This program, I have to admit to all, was a failure. We call it an abject failure. We suspended the pilot program and launched a comprehensive review, and what we learned was that additional resources were needed. Community capacity had to be built, and we needed to develop scientifically sound research methods as well. So what did we change? We formalized relationships with our community providers. We hired a full-time navigator to assist those when they left our facility and actually expanded that to add another navigator. We improved communication across systems, and we established a comprehensive research arm within our facility. This helped us create Matador 2.0, now a national model for its combination of in-house planning and post-release supports. Patient navigators work for us. They screen individuals prior to their release. Then they build a relationship on the inside, which then continues on the outside with reminders for appointments, assistance with adjustments back, resources and guidance to be a partner in reentry. And it has been recognized by SAMHSA, by the National Sheriff's Association, by National Commission on Correctional Healthcare, National Governors Association, and others. This Matador 3.0, which we are going through right now, is the third and current iteration of the program. This came as a collaboration across sheriffs and legislators. This involves expanded therapy to all three FDA-approved forms of medication-assisted treatment, methadone, buprenorphine, otherwise known as Suboxone usually, and naltrexone injectable, known as Vivitrol. Also, it allows for patient-centered prescribing. The three-year pilot began in September 1st of 2019 with maintenance of verifiable prescriptions based upon the recommendation of a qualified addiction specialist. We will also induce individuals based upon the same recommendation from a specialist 30 days prior to release, and prescriptions and dosages are determined by the same specialist and tailored to the individual needs. Our 120-day analysis, the number of doses administered today is approximately 70, with almost 83% of individuals enrolled in the program having a prior medication-assisted treatment prescription at one point in their lives. We also saw anecdotal evidence that Matador is changing lives, and so we wanted to be able to show proof of this. Our one-year post-release recidivism study, we used propensity matching, which is equally as good, really, as randomized controlled trial. Our Matador recidivism rate was just under 11%, which is remarkable considering this population. The recidivism rate of our control group was more than two times at almost 25% for that same propensity matched group. More importantly, harm reduction of the more than 500 inmates who received one or more naltrexone treatments since the program's inception, over 95% have not succumbed to a fatal overdose. I'll now get into the recommendations on regulations. Our experiences, positive and negative, have provided me with some recommendations. We must strengthen the two pillars in which a successful MAT program rests: treatment and access to medication. Rigid federal regulations jeopardize sometimes the integrity of both pillars. For example, the loss of federal Medicaid benefits upon incarceration, especially for those pretrial, creates an obstacle towards the continuous reentry of MAT upon reentry and punishes those who ought to be presumed innocent. I have worked with senators on legislation to address this, and the federal health care benefits should not be suspended for those who have not been convicted of a crime. So I believe, and a number of organizations believe, that federal law should affirmatively protect the entitlement to health care benefits before conviction. Another recommendation is with regard to HIPAA. HIPAA allows for the sharing of protected health information between correctional institutions and health providers for the purposes of treatment. Records created as part of substance use treatment typically require consent authorization, but individuals in our facility battling an SUD may lack the soundness of mind to make good decisions in their best interests and in their own best health. Inflexibility in privacy laws compromise patient-centered care by preventing information sharing between providers inside and outside, a critical element to continuity of care. And finally, DEA regulations for MAT should be reviewed. We recognize operational challenges exist to providing buprenorphine and methadone inside a correctional facility. Regulations and guidelines are interpreted differently from region to region. Regulations were developed as a needed safeguard for community-level dispensing of MAT to prevent diversion. Applying the same regulatory standard to correctional agencies in which stringent security provisions exist is an overly burdensome requirement, and loosening regulatory barriers is a targeted bipartisan solution that would have a significant impact on how widely and how well we can provide treatment to the incarcerated population. Our experience shows that corrections-based MAT program is worthy of replication when anchored in data and linked to community-based aftercare. We can help establish a universal standard of care that stabilizes an individual during the period of incarceration, gets them on the appropriate track, and links them to the community-based care back in the community. I will say in closing, it is important to note that we say medication-assisted treatment. We cannot just give individuals medication and assume that it is answering our problem, but they need that treatment. Establishing, testing, and sustaining an MAT program is hard work. It has been hard work. MAT programs are an important avenue through which we can address this crisis. Our data shows that quite clearly, and the evolution of our Matador program offers a learning lens from which other agencies can look and have looked as they have wished to pilot a similar program. And we are willing to offer our insight and expertise to agencies to assist. We appreciate the opportunity to testify today. Thank you for your consideration of these recommendations, and we are at your service as we are committed to this issue as you are, and I am happy to answer with my colleagues that have also presented any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheriff, for your valued testimony and your service. Let the record reflect that Commissioner Ramsey joined our call earlier as well. Commissioners, we're now open for questions for the first three panelists. If I could request, would commissioners with a question please state your name prior to your question and direct the question to a specific panelist you have a question for, or if it's for response from the entire panel, please state so. Just as a reminder, the commissioners, your mics are hot at all times. Thank you, commissioners. With questions, please ask.
This is Ashley Moody out of Florida. I have a question for Carson Fox.
Yes, Commissioner.
Yes. And I really appreciated also the testimony from Michael Cena, the director of HIDA, especially when he talked about the decriminalization in certain areas and how that might affect opportunity for addicted individuals to actually get intensive treatment. And as a former prosecutor and a judge for over a decade, I saw how successful alternative courts, drug courts, could be in affecting lives of those that, due to an addiction, could not conform to drug laws. And so I wondered if you might have information of jurisdictions or areas where you feel like there were missed opportunities for treatment for individuals because a certain area was decriminalizing drug offenses, and therefore there was no longer any oversight or impetus for these individuals to get treatment.
Thank you, Commissioner Moody. I love that question. It's what it really brings me to is there's this large issue that the treatment courts are facing, where they need to get the right people into treatment. They need to get folks into treatment. They need to identify them, and it's difficult to say if I've seen jurisdictions where someone's not had access to treatment, because when I talk to the folks out as I go around the country in treatment courts, and I think everybody on the call probably has seen this, that and some of the panelists, I think both panelists also mentioned this as well, or either alluded to it, most of the folks that we're seeing, they're not using one substance, they're polysubstance users. And they might be arrested for one thing, but they're using, and they'll talk in treatment about they're using everything out there. And they also, more likely than not, and SAMHSA has this information, as I'm sure we've all heard, that more likely than not, a huge percentage of these folks has a co-occurring mental health disorder. So to go directly to your question, it's hard to say, because it's almost like trying to prove the negative. But I can say that there's concern, there's some concern out there that sometimes they might not be able to identify the right folks, but that could be when I hear from the stories from the front lines, it could be for a variety of reasons. And there's a lot of concern, particularly about youth, and for the juvenile drug courts, that they're not able to get young people into the program for one reason or another. One thing that's been interesting is that, and I've heard this from several jurisdictions, is that it might not be as much even about drug crime specifically as other crimes, where if people aren't identified, then they might not be, I don't know, it's a difficult question. I'm trying to figure out the right answer. I guess it's one of those things where, especially with youth, juvenile drug courts are so tremendously successful with working with young people and diverting people out of having any other involvement in the justice system. And getting them into treatment is so important. And so having that focus on youth and having officers, and I can't say that juvenile drug courts are the only answer out there, and I think that we all know when we're dealing with our youth and we're dealing with the problem of the youth being introduced to drug use, that we have to use every arrow in our quiver. And juvenile drug courts are only just one of those arrows. And so I think that the question is a fantastic question, and it's one of those things where my information is more anecdotal, and like I said, jurisdictions wrestle with that, Commissioner, but it's hard for them to say again, because when they'll talk to me about it, they're trying to prove a negative, and it's hard to say who's not coming into the justice system. They have a difficult time teasing that out. But there definitely is concern, and what I hear concern about is about the youth and just being able to ramp up programs for the youth, specifically juvenile drug courts, but also other programs in the justice system, and like was said on this call, programs that keep youth from ever getting into the justice system. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, somewhat. I think many times when we see multiple drug offenses, it appears the only thing that keeps people accountable to treatment, because certainly if they had someone or something that was outside the system that could keep them accountable to treatment, it would have been done. So when the only thing that can keep someone accountable is a judge and a court system and the prospect of more stringent penalties, it appears to me that this movement for decriminalization, as opposed to intensive treatment and diversion, is dangerous. And so I wondered if you might have statistics related to that. But I do appreciate the answer, and thank you for that.
Mr. Chairman, yes, so this is Peter Cattugi, and I thought I got cut off. I didn't hear the obligatory applause when I finished my presentation, so I didn't know if I cut myself off or lost it, but I'm back here to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Sheriff.
Hey, this is Katie Sullivan. I have a question about OD mapping. And so it sounds like that there would be a request that, I guess the thing I'm not understanding about the OD maps is, first of all, it's only as good as the people putting it in, which are typically first responders, right? And then they may have some kind of safety or other concerns. And then do we know exactly the narcotic, do we know the type of narcotic that's responsible for the OD? Because the methamphetamine problem has taken over so much, and are we able to really use the OD map to be tracking where meth is an issue, where we're getting ahead of the opioid issue through this mapping? And is there any kind of notification function for local and federal narcotics investigators? So I see some issues with the OD mapping and the usefulness of it. Are some of those improvements, could that make them more viable? Or I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Madam Vice Chair, it's Mike Senna on the phone. So just to give you kind of an idea, because the OD map is really kind of that canary out there in the coal mine, indicating that there was a potential overdose, suspected overdose. So it just gives you that indication. It doesn't say what type of drug it may be. Local law enforcement knows what's out there in their field, but it's not until you have a lab analysis to determine if you've got enough samples or a medical examination to determine what potentially was the main cause of overdose. But again, with polydrug use, it may be multiple drugs that are in the person's system. So first off, you have either a first responder that is inputting the data, or someone from public health, or someone from the medical profession that's putting that data into the system. But we also have use of that overlaying into existing EMT systems, where it's more of an automated process, where folks are actually using their own diagnostic tools and reporting tools in the field, and then that data is being absorbed through their tools to reduce, the work that people have to put into the system. Now, the other portion of that is the analysis phase, the intelligence and information sharing phase, and that involves public health analysts, it involves drug intelligence officers, and those people that can look deeper into, one, are we having, multiple people reporting the same incidents, or is this a real trend and spike? So that follow-up is part of the job of the HIDTA personnel within each of their investigative support centers, intelligence support centers across the country that are developing and expanding on the OD map system. Now, the other portion of that is that, again, it just shows a spike in suspected overdoses. So that report, and that report can come out every day or as frequently as people want, but it'll give all of those public health responders, and there's really two settings, one that allows people to push the data into ODMAP, and then one that allows qualified personnel to look at the data within their region to be able to better understand what the potential threats are. And that's kind of how that discussion of COVID-19, having that ability for folks to go up and open up a web-optimized portal and click a few buttons to say what they're seeing only tells you that these are the types of incidents. And there's, a few simple buttons to click, and they're whether the person died and what they believe may be a suspected overdose, and whether they lived, and whether naloxone was used, and whether it was one dosage or multiple dosages, due to the fact that fentanyl and carfentanil take a lot more, usually, to bring people back with the use of naloxone to figure out, if that was a potential overdose due to fentanyl. But there's a lot of work on the back end that has to be done to give, I shouldn't say the most, truly 100% accurate data, but at least more accurate data and a lot more data than currently law enforcement, public health, and the medical professionals have related to that. And we recently did this with, in my own area, in one of our counties, where in 2018 they had 9 overdose deaths, and the next year they had 96. And it was broken down because in some parts of the country, methamphetamine is killing as many people as opioids are, and that was certainly the case in this one county that I have in Northern California, where we had almost an equal number of those that were died from methamphetamine overdoses as had died from the opioid overdoses.
Thank you so much. I also have a question for Carson Fox, if that's okay, Mr. Chairman. Can I double dip, Phil?
Absolutely. Absolutely, Commissioner. You've been recognized.
Okay, thank you. So my question is this. We had a recommendation in a different panel with a panelist who was a researcher, talked about the research behind drug courts and things like that. Basically, the recommendation was that BJA create some kind of a list of protocols. Not, and I asked and pushed a little bit on the 10 key components and said, we already have the 10 key components. And they said, right, but how they are actually being implemented from court to court. One of the things that came up was the importance of the judge, but then also that fine line that a judge walks in a drug court between the respect, like General Moody was talking about, kind of this respect for the criminal justice system, that they are in the criminal justice system, and also making it a treatment-centered environment, and how some judges have gone, you know, sort of too far away from, you know, really maintaining criminal justice type of thing. So I'm wondering, and I'm remembering, this actually wasn't a panelist. This was a subject matter expert that talked to my working group. But his recommendation is we start to come up with some actual protocols. So if that was to happen, where do you see those protocols being necessary? And if you agree with that recommendation.
Hi, thank you. First, Vice Chair Sullivan, I appreciate the question. For adult drug courts, really I think the protocols are already enmeshed in the adult drug court best practice standards that were put together. Those standards, there's two volumes of the standards that were put together, and you know this because we've had this discussion. DJA has been working, and SAMHSA has been working with us to train drug courts across the country on those standards. The whole development of the standards, the idea behind them was with the 10 key components having been put in place as a cooperative effort between NADCP and DJA back in the 1990s, that then there, with all this research that came out, and the research showed just a tremendous amount of success from drug courts. It showed that drug courts were the most successful criminal justice intervention as far as the researchers were concerned ever, particularly for the population in adult drug court, because it showed that adult drug courts were successful with a population of folks that no other intervention had ever been successful with. So when we looked at that 15, 20 years of research, we put together the adult drug court best practice standards. And what we've done since then is we've worked with researchers and with Bureau of Justice Assistance and with SAMHSA at crosswalking them the best we can to the other court models. And one example I'll give you is Veterans Treatment Courts. So crosswalking them over to and working with researchers on, okay, so which of these standards that we know applies to adult drug courts, then therefore we can crosswalk, and these would also apply to Veterans Treatment Courts. And the reason we have to do that is because there's been so much research done on adult drug courts. There's so much that it's very difficult to find researchers who are even interested in researching treatment courts, because what they'll tell you is the research is unequivocal. They work. They would rather work on something that is more questionable. And so there's not nearly as much research on the other treatment court models as there is on the adult drug court model. OJJDP did work on, and we have great best practices now put together for juvenile drug courts and for family treatment courts. So I think those are there. So I think in some way I love the suggestion from the subject matter expert, but I believe the protocols are already embedded in those examples. And to go specifically to some of those protocols and the question you raised, you mentioned the judge's role. In the best practice standards, there's actually a specific standard on the role of the judge, because there's been so much research done on that particular role. And there are some very specific protocols within that standard, things that the judge should do. The amount of time that a judge, for example, spends interacting with someone is directly related to the success of the program. That's just one example. How long the judge presides over the court in the research has a direct correlation to how well that court performs. That, for example, was tremendously important, because for years there were courts in the country where judges rotated in and out of a court every few months. And what they found in the research was the performance of the graduates in those courts were not nearly as good as the courts who had a judge who maintained a docket for a longer period of time. So I think the protocols are in place. And I think that we could do some more work on the additional treatment court models and working on doing some more crosswalking. And there's always room for more research into the models that don't have as much as the adult drug courts with, for example, veterans treatment courts. There's always more research so that we can shore things up. And then as research continues to come on board, I will say that when we developed the best practice standards, we had folks from OJP on the panel, we had folks from SAMHSA on the panel, And we all recognized that there were still areas, there were deficits, where there wasn't enough research in certain areas. And so I think that there's also time to look at those, and there's time to spend some effort looking at, well, where do we need some more research? And I'll just give one example of that. One thing that we've seen across programs, and this is not just in treatment court programs, is a very much enhanced use of mentors in all different capacities. I mean, veteran treatment courts have mentors. There's also mentors who help people in substance use treatment, and getting some research in helping us figure out exactly what protocols are there specifically so that folks can use those to the maximum capacity. But I really appreciate the question. I think it's a fantastic question, and I think that the leadership that OJP has had in this particular area has been tremendous on the growth of just that. And I think the more, now that we have those protocols in place, the more that we can have, it's helpful so that courts have, when they're starting a treatment court or continuing their treatment court, they can rely on those, because the whole reason they were put together was that the courts that do those things have been proven in all this research to have the best possible outcomes. So thank you for that question.
Hey, Bill. David Roush.
Commissioner Roush, recognized.
Hey, Sheriff, I appreciate your testimony, and I have a question based on kind of what we're hearing from your peers and from other panelists, and even from Director Cena today, talking to individuals who've experienced addiction, and the statement that I thought was pretty significant was they fear that this ability of intervention will be lessened as we continue to go forward with some of the reforms that we're seeing. So quite frankly, saying going to prison and getting treatment was what saved them. So and I am also getting this impression that we no longer are really seeing detention centers. They're really treatment centers anymore, and that has to have an impact on your staffing and who you have working in your facilities now. And can you touch a little bit on that in terms of the change that's been made because of the high level of addiction issues, and how that, you know, what we need to be doing going forward?
So that's a great question, Commissioner. The field of corrections has changed significantly. Sort of like the idea that, you know, you can't arrest or incarcerate your way out of crime. You can't do the same, you can't arrest or incarcerate your way out of corrections either. So there has been a movement, and I would really in some ways suggest that society has a great deal of responsibility in this, because as society is not providing for the needs of the population that we tend to treat, those people end up becoming incarcerated. So as I said, I'm proud of the programs we run, but you shouldn't have to come to a jail to get good treatment. And by the way, when you get back out in the community, once you leave our facility, you should have good access to good treatment and programs so you don't have to come back again. I believe that a lot of these folks are about 50% of our population coming in have a history of mental health. 42%, as I had stated before, have to be medically have to go through medically managed withdrawal. This is a very sick population that's not being dealt with on the outside, and we're dealing with it on the inside. And it's no secret that the three largest mental health treatment facilities in the country are L.A., Rikers, and Cook County jails. And we are the largest in our county, as every jail is in their counties. And we've got a couple of psychiatric hospitals here in Middlesex County. We're still by far the largest. This is something that we are having to change, and we're dealing with issues that we never had to deal with before. And it has changed the way that we have to consider taking people in, but as well as turning them out. I also think it's important to note that sheriffs across the country have been very dedicated to turning out people better. You know, our reentry planning begins on day one, their first day that they come to our facility. Their reentry planning starts on that day. We don't wait for any time, and we put them through a rigorous number of programs to address their criminogenic needs and factors, stabilizing mental health, addressing substance use, but many other things, in an effort to put them out a little bit better than when they came in. And that's really, the mission has changed significantly, and this is where we can do our most good. And by the way, when we turn people out better than when they came in, we make our community safer, We hopefully don't have to have them incarcerated again, so we can save more money. They get their jobs. They tend to their family. They're not on social programs. Their families are not on social programs. They tend to their family. They have a job. They're earning wages, and they're paying taxes. And if you can, by the way, if you can stem that at one generation, then imagine the good that you can do, because the children of incarcerated individuals have a much higher likelihood to have truancies in schools, failures in education, sociopathic behavior, and greater and higher levels of incarceration as well.
This is Eric McDonald. Am I permitted to ask a question or two?
Yes, Commissioner.
Okay. And I got to outdo Katie, but I think I might triple dip here. But it's all to Carson Fox. First of all, I want to echo thank you to all of our law enforcement who is on the front line. Thank you, Chair King, for throwing it out there just bluntly that you guys don't have the option of teleworking and you are out there fighting for all this, and we deeply and greatly appreciate it. With respect to drug court, prior to being the United States Attorney here, I was a district court judge for over 8 years, and I was one of our drug court judges as well as one of our family treatment court judges, as well as one of our juvenile court judges, which dealt with child protection. And what I think the American population, sometimes I think it's a war on drug, and I try to explain it's a fight for our families. When you see our CHIP cases are through the roof because parents suffering from their addiction just aren't able to parent appropriately. So here's my thoughts about drug court, and I want to hear your thoughts, Mr. Fox, on this. First is to follow up on General Moody's question. You know, as those crimes are reduced to misdemeanor offenses, so for in Minnesota, for example, in order our intake is in order to qualify for drug court, you would have two prior fifth-degree possession would get you there. A first wouldn't, because you would get a state of adjudication, and there's no incentive to go into drug court. It's only that fear of prison that really is what, I mean, people would stand before me, would say, I want to use drugs. I'm only doing this because I don't want to go to prison. I don't know what to do. I'm at my last hope. And so, you know, we've got to get the word out there, and what can we do? This misplaced compassion of reducing these crimes to misdemeanor level offenses, we're not going to reach the population we need to reach before they kill themselves or do more damage. So that's first, the reduction of crime. Working group is looking at this, and we talked about just this morning on an earlier call, is this reclassifications of crimes is one of the drivers of crime. Second, bail reform. I want to hear your thoughts on that. To the extent that there's this bail reform issue out there where we're just going to let people out, you know, a lot of times the only way I could stabilize someone and get them to where they need to be to even make the right decisions for themselves, but also be able to get into drug court, I had to have them in jail until such time as I could get them to inpatient treatment. And so this idea that we're going to release them immediately upon catch without stabilizing them frightens me to no end. And then the third question that I have is, as a drug court judge, I became drug court judge in a mature drug court. And when I was designated to be one of the drug court judges, there was no funding for me to go to any treatment, or not treatment, sorry, no, to go to training. And what I was told and what we've been told ever since is that, you know, the funding goes to train judges who are new or they're starting up drug courts. We really have to be able to, what can we do about funding to make sure that all judges are certified, if you will, before they become drug court judges? So those are my three parts.
Thank you, Commissioner. That's a lot to bite off. Okay, so so first of all, and this will go back to Commissioner Moody's question as well, there are a lot of jurisdictions that are struggling over just the reclassification of charges. And one thing I can tell you that they're doing really successfully and that a lot of jurisdictions had gone there before is just looking at the whole population of folks who could potentially come into drug court, because we all know drugs and alcohol drive the criminal justice system, and I speak all over the country, and I'll speak to different groups, and we know that depending on the state or the jurisdiction, the number is always somewhere between 75% and 85%. But I'll ask folks all around the country, I'll say, about what percentage of the folks in your justice system here, their crimes are driven by drugs and alcohol. And they'll always consistently say that. They'll be 80%, 85%, 88%, 92%. And so what they're doing is, and this was in the President's Opioid Commission report that came out a couple of years ago, there was only a couple recommendations specific to drug court, and one of them was for drug courts to look to probation revocation cases, because probation revocation cases, and for many of folks, when you're, we all know that as a judge, and there are many former judges on this group, when a judge places somebody on probation, you decided that person comes out of probation. And so they, so you place them on probation, not a threat to public safety. What we have found, and this is in working with CJA and ONDCP, is that there's this tremendous number of cases. In some states, it was 55 to 85% of the cases of people who were terminated from probation were terminated for not complying with the terms of treatment or testing positive. And there was a drug court in their community, and for whatever reason, they were not referred to that drug court. And those were the people who were the most high need and high risk people, and for whatever reason, they weren't. So the President's Commission on Opioid Commission a couple of years ago made that recommendation, and since then, we've seen tremendous inroads. And BJA is, and ONDCP have been huge leaders in this, and just leading, getting drug courts to look at that population of folks and to bring people in to drug court who are at the highest risk and the highest need, because we know those are the folks who can do the best in these programs. But then also looking at, and I talked about the young man in Charleston, and this is something that I tell people all the time. Drug courts have always, traditionally, they're thought of as taking in drug crimes. By far, when you go out, and when I go out across the country, drug courts take in crimes that aren't drug crimes. I mean, I've been in drug courts where they'll say that they brought in $100,000 of restitution the year before. I was in a drug court, I think it was in South Carolina, a couple of years ago, and their target population did not even include drug crimes. And South Carolina hasn't had any of the recharging issues because what they were looking at was drug-driven crimes. That was what was impacting their communities. So that's a focus a lot of these communities are looking at. Because, again, the people who work in drug courts and the people who make up the membership in NADCP, they're not in the legislative branch. They're in the judicial and the executive branch. And so they're looking at how do we respond to these changes in the law, and they've got these, and they've realized they've got these populations of folks who are in dire need. I mean, if you look at the statistics, over half the people in prison in the country are people who are there on probation revocation, and the tremendous bulk of those people were people who were originally adjudicated by a judge on probation, so they were determined to not be threats to their community, and they're basically now in jail for status offenses on their probation. So that answers, I hope, several of the questions you had. And can you remind me of the last question?
Drug court funding for judges for training when we have new judges coming into mature drug courts.
I think that's critical. We offer training in concert with BJA every year, and judges should know. And if judges don't know, that's on us, because we have it on our website. We have materials that we've produced in cooperation with BJA that are always available. We're always available with technical assistance to assist judges, and we've got host of webinars online that we can do, but there are trainings available nearly every year. Sometimes it's every year and sometimes it's not, depending on the amount of people who apply for it. There's a judicial training we have, and those trainings have had sometimes just a few a year, and there's over 100 judges there. And the judges will tell me it's like drinking through a fire hose. It's exactly, when you were mentioning about training, exactly the kind of thing that you were looking for, and it's something that we've done it in cooperation with the National Judicial College in Reno for many years, and judges go there and they spend 5 days and they learn about all the stuff. They learn about drug court, they learn about psychopharmacology, they learn about drug testing, and it's a tremendously well-received training. I mean, it's probably our most popular training that we have, but I can say that we have new judges in there, but new judges from existing courts are probably half of the group, because we recognize that those are folks who that you come into a court, just like you said, you could come into a court that's been operating and cooking with gas for 6 years, and you're the brand new judge, and you need to come up to speed, and so we offer that. But if judges can't get to that training, we'll do whatever we can do. I mean, I've gone personally out to courts myself to sit down and talk with a judge, and work with them to do everything I could possibly do to bring them up to speed. And this is, you can probably tell from just what I'm talking about here, this is my passion. This is my life's work. It's what I do. And so we stand ready to help any judge in the country, anybody who calls me, anybody who contacts an ADCP, who is looking for training, and they're a new judge, they're a new probation officer, they're a new treatment provider, whatever, and they've been assigned to the drug court, and they need information, we will get it to them if it's the last thing I do. And so I want to assure you of that, that we are a resource, and we work 7 days a week, 365 days a year to do that. And it's our joy to do it because, as you know, and has been mentioned on this panel already, the folks working in drug court, they're doing the Lord's work. I mean, it is not easy work. And they make such a difference. So we do everything that we can do to make their lift a little easier. So thank you for that question.
Other commissioners? Okay, if not, to our panelists, on behalf of all the commissioners, Attorney General Barr and his leadership team, we want to thank you for your most valued testimony. Again, Sheriff Katujan will be leading the call now. Mr. Fox and Dirk and Cena, please feel free to leave the call or stay with us for the next panel, which will start in 15 minutes. Any questions or comments from commissioners? If not, operator, could you mute all lines? We'll stay in recess for 15 minutes.
Yes, sir. Just a moment, please.
Welcome back to the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and the Administration of Justice teleconference call. Commissioners, when you're about to ask a question, please make sure you unmute your phone by hitting star 6. Thank you. Our next panelist today is Mr. Michael Stewart, who is the distinguished United States Attorney for the Southern District of West Virginia. Mr. Stewart, thank you for joining us today, and you're now recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Madam Vice Chair, members of the Commission. I'm Mike Stewart, the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of West Virginia, and I certainly appreciate the invitation to testify before you today, and I'm honored to do so. You know, I apologize I haven't been able to provide my statement to you in advance, but I literally got the invitation last week. And since that time, like you, I have been consumed with COVID-19 and managing my district and my professionals and trying to address fraud and other issues. So today I'm simply going to speak from the notes I've been able to put together and my experiences in the district. We have many ideas and proposals regarding the issue. And I'm going to lay out a few today, but I certainly encourage folks to reach out if they have questions or want greater input. Now, first, I want to point out that my testimony today is mine alone. I don't speak for the Attorney General, Attorney General Barr, or the Department of Justice. It is merely my experience and my perspective. Just a bit of background on me. I'm the son and grandson of coal miners, proudly so. I'm from the hills and hollers of West Virginia, also proudly so. And I earned and paid my own way through college at West Virginia University and law school at Boston University. I'm the oldest of more than 64 grandkids on my dad's side, big family. One of only a few to attend college and the only one of that family with an advanced degree. I've sure been very, very lucky in my career. Growing up the way I did in West Virginia, though, I understand the people of this state, what motivates them, how they think, the challenges they face. As I often tell new recruits from out of state to my office, and there are a lot of those, the people of West Virginia did not choose their circumstance. It chose them. My state is particularly challenged on many levels, economically, high levels of poverty, low levels of educational attainment, poor health statistics, the second oldest population in the country, and a population that was crushed, literally crushed by the opiate epidemic. There's not a city or town or church or school or street or family in West Virginia that hasn't been personally impacted by this crisis, and it's generational. From father to son to grandson. West Virginia has had the unwanted distinction of having the most overdose deaths per capita in the nation for multiple years. The highest rate of grandparents raising grandchildren in the nation due primarily to substance abuse. And a true crisis of children, record numbers being placed in foster care. A system that's not close to prepared to give those children the love or nurturing every child deserves. It's the next societal crisis we will be dealing with, everyone on this call. I carry in my pocket each day, not as a gimmick and not as a prop, the pictures of the children who've become victims to the scourge. It is a tragically expanding stack of pictures. I attend the funerals. I embrace the moms and dads, the point of their deepest and most poignant loss. It's painful, it's emotional, it's personal to my people, and it's personal to me. And it's a challenge for which there is no easy escape. As U.S. Attorney, I'm profoundly honored to serve alongside the brave men and women of law enforcement. We have forged, during my time here, I think some of the strongest partnerships at the federal, state, and local levels in the history of the district. Soon after becoming U.S. Attorney, we executed the largest single takedown in the history of the state in Huntington, with more than 200 law enforcement officers and 50 National Guardsmen. I got a lot of questions about the National Guardsmen from the national media, trust me. Huntington was in crisis with low morale and a seeming resignation to the perpetual nature of the drug crisis. We put helicopters in the air. We blanketed the street with law enforcement. And a city embraced it and was inspired to the hope of our assault on the drug dealers and poison peddlers. The community embraced law enforcement with pats on the back and attaboys when they hit the Shoney's on Sunday. Today, because of aggressive and tough enforcement, remarkably tight partnerships, and an engaged social intervention network in Huntington, it's experienced some of the largest reductions in overdose leading to death and crime in the nation. Year over year, in 2018, overdoses were down by, get this, 40%. That was 40%. Fatal overdoses and other crimes are also down by record numbers. We ask too much of law enforcement today. I'm often, when I get the chance to speak with folks, I remember before I was U.S. Attorney, the Dallas police chief, during that terrible attack on those police officers, he once said, and I have this, and I think it's important for us to keep perspective of, quote, we're asking cops to do too much in this country. Not enough mental health funding, let the cops handle it. Not enough drug addiction funding, let's give it to the cops. Public safety is of the utmost importance to all Americans. However, far too often throughout the country today, law enforcement's disrespected and heavily burdened to solve every societal failure. While our military protects us from international threats, law enforcement serves the role of protecting the nation from domestic threats. Law enforcement is our domestic military. But while we spend unlimited amounts to fund and prepare our military, we do not provide the same level of support or commitment to law enforcement. The challenges are many, and I'll be real brief on this. Law enforcement fatigue. The crisis of substance abuse has gone on far too long. There is just fatigue among law enforcement to this crisis. Law enforcement demoralization, number two. Revolving doors, bail reform initiatives, social justice reforms, sanctuary declarations by city and states, decriminalization efforts with respect to drugs and legalization efforts for marijuana. And in some parts of the country, not here in West Virginia, but in some parts of the country, outright hostility against law enforcement. It undermines and demoralizes our troops, our law enforcement professionals. Social justice activists, in some cases, are drowning out the vast majority of our citizens. And I mean the vast majority who want law and order and safety. Number three, the normalization of addiction and substance abuse in America today. Number four, the defining of substance abuse as purely a public health crisis. Now, what I mean there is that there are elements of this crisis that will find their solutions in the healthcare system, but there are other elements of this crisis that will find their solutions through enforcement, punishment, and imprisonment. That's a good thing, not a bad thing. Law enforcement is fatigued because the terms of victory have not been defined. And so I have just a number of recommendations I'd like your consideration on, and again, I appreciate your time. But I want to point out that the solutions for this crisis must be both micro and macro. A pure micro approach will never get us where we need to be. We cannot micro. Just like we cannot arrest our way out of this, we can't hug our way out of this either, but we can't micro our way out of this. Here are my recommendations. One, be bold in your proposals. And let me tell you, the son and grandson of coal miners who fought his way through school and became a U.S. attorney didn't get here because he was timid. This nation wasn't built on TEMED. I want you to think outside the box. I encourage you to think big and make big proposals here. Two, we must end the fallacy that the substance abuse crisis is merely the responsibility of law enforcement. It is not. In fact, law enforcement and the justice system is not in a position to end the substance abuse crisis by themselves, individually or collectively. Number three, we need to define what victory over substance abuse is and what it looks like. And I'll tell you what it doesn't look like. 70,000 people dying every year from overdose. Number four, we must end the substance abuse crisis. And I know there's some of you listening to me saying, we can't do that. I'm here to tell you that we can, and we must. Our very social fabric and our culture is under attack. It must be our top priority. Don't let anyone tell you we can't solve this problem. But how do we do it? It starts with the total, this is the macro. It starts with the total targeted destruction of the drug cartels. The American people are living through the hell of COVID-19 today. But the worst, by the worst estimates, between 100,000 and 240,000 could lose their lives to this invisible enemy. And the country has gone to work collectively, working together to take on this challenge. We'll defeat this challenge. By comparison, this year and every year, nearly 70,000 people will lose their lives to overdose. In the past three decades, more than 870,000 people, and that figure doesn't include the victims of addiction or crimes like murder or assault. The real victims are in the tens of millions from the substance abuse crisis. This can't be allowed to continue. And reducing the figures by 5% a year, which are good numbers for us, is equally unacceptable. We must engage in a vigorous supply destruction and destroy the cartels, and we need to do it on their turf. Number five, we need to be careful we don't allow medically assisted treatment to usher in a new type of substance abuse crisis. Number six, involuntary temporary commitment treatment of those between the ages of 18 and 26. And I picked those numbers because it's similar to our health care provisions that allow our children to remain on our parents' health insurance, to allow for parents to intervene with substance abuse issues, that point in their lives that is most implicated by substance abuse. Number seven, training for law enforcement officers on overdose investigations. They must be treated as crime scenes, and there must be accountability to the dealers and suppliers that killed our youth and our family members. Number eight, sentencing guidelines, and sentences need to be commensurate with the crime. Here in West Virginia, Subutex and Suboxone may be treatment solutions, but they're also problems. The largest recorded pharmaceutical theft in the history of West Virginia happened last year. It was tens of thousands of doses of Suboxone, but the defendant served virtually no time because the sentencing guidelines didn't recognize the gravity of the illicit trade of Suboxone. Number nine, outside-the-box solutions. I call this surge resources. West Virginia has been assaulted by places like Detroit and Akron, Ohio, and the drug dealers who were supplied from the cartels. We need to be able to surge federal resources to be able to go into these areas and literally destroy and decimate the drug trade and the poison peddlers. We need to make it as difficult for these folks to operate as possible. And just two more. One, number 10, redemption and second chances. In places like West Virginia, an incredibly high percentage of our youth, they make terrible decisions, just like all youth do, and they get involved with drugs. People make mistakes in life. We need to provide opportunities and hope to those who seek second chances by creating pathways for careers in law enforcement. Yeah, law enforcement, even for those folks who made that big mistake. Frankly, their reformed perspective on drugs and drug abuse may be a perfect foundation for empathetic and effective law enforcement agents. And finally, my penchant for big ideas, it's time in this country that we have a GI Bill for law enforcement, similar to the benefits we provide to veterans on their return from World War II. Law enforcement today in America are on the front lines of domestic stability. They are our domestic military. We need to be thinking about the benefits we can give these folks for their incredible public service and the protection and the public safety they provide. And so I know that was a few minutes longer than my 7 minutes, but I thank you for your patience. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you, and I'm available to answer any questions. And you can follow up with me, not hard to find, with any questions or criticisms you may have, because I know there are probably a lot of folks who are like, where did we get this guy from? But hey, this is just the perspective of one guy who's living through this crisis in a state that's been decimated. Thank you.
Thank you for your most informative and robust testimony, Ms. Stewart. Like you, I paid my way through school, too. Now for our next panelist today, we have Sue DeLancey, who is Chief Deputy at the Orange County Probation Department. Chief Deputy DeLancey, thank you for joining us today, and you're recognized.
Thank you very much, Chairman Keith and Honorable Commission members. I'm Sue DeLancey, and the Chief Probation Officer of Orange County, California. I'm humbled at the opportunity to speak with you today, and thank you for prioritizing this important issue. In a couple of months, I will celebrate 30 years with my department, and I'm pleased to say that I can finally see some of the pieces falling into place to address the impact of substance use on law enforcement and the administration of justice in Orange County. Within the field of probation, we have the unique ability, and I would say responsibility, to build relationships with our law enforcement, correctional and behavioral health, county, state, and community partners. It is through the collaboration of the community systems of care and law enforcement that allows us to identify the high utilizers or frequent flyers of our services and address the underlying issues facing these individuals. One of Orange County's most effective and long-standing programs addressing some of these issues is our drug treatment court, which began in 1995. In addition to drug court, we currently have DUI treatment court, a veterans treatment court, recovery court, opportunity court, along with whatever it takes court that deals with chronic mental illness and homelessness. As several of my panel members, along with previous commissioners, raised in the question period, several states have changed the charging and sentencing guidelines, resulting in misdemeanor charges instead of felony charges. As you may know, California is one of those states. So with the drug court program that is a minimum of 18 months, our team had to be flexible when addressing eligibility. The key is that they needed to make certain that the participant's criminal conduct is substantially caused by a substance abuse disorder and not just open the program to very sophisticated criminals that may use drugs. As Mr. Fox stated in his written testimony, the drug court model is designed for individuals where their substance use has contributed to more serious crimes and face long-term incarceration. I'm proud to say that law enforcement is a key member of our treatment courts, which continue to be successful in providing its participants the tools to live a self-directed life, reduce recidivism, and increase community safety. Another legislation that changed the population of our county jails was the impact of substance use on law enforcement in California was AB 109, commonly known as realignment. This was enacted to address the overcrowding in California's 33 prisons. This law mandates that individuals sentenced to non-serious, non-violent, or non-sex offenses serve their sentences in county jail instead of state prisons. It also changed the population of county jails by mandating that they house individuals serving parole and post-release community supervision violations. As a result, county jails have seen an increase in violence towards both staff and other inmates, along with drugs as contraband since 2011. As we've discussed, drug overdose is now the leading cause of accidental death in America, with Orange County's overdose mortality rate higher than the state average. In an effort to address this crisis, the county applied and was awarded a grant to participate in the expanding MAT in county criminal justice settings, a learning collaborative in 2018. This was a joint effort of the California Department of Health Care Agency and Health Management Associates. The team had representatives from the health care agency on both the correctional health side and behavioral health services, the Orange County Sheriff's Department, Orange County Probation Department, Superior Courts, and the county CEO's office. Our team implemented a variety of practices countywide that increased the use of MAT using evidence-based practices. We found that one of the most important pieces of this expansion is education. It is critical that all of the players including the individuals receiving MAT, have a basic understanding of the neuroscience of addiction. As I'm sure the sheriff would attest, law enforcement, probation officers, along with many community members, will share their criticism of you exchanging one drug for another or using taxpayer dollars to buy and supply jail inmates with drugs. I have learned that there needs to be an ongoing process. You need to build on their knowledge and provide statistics when possible and success stories before you can change a culture. In order to support the Administration of Justice, I offer the following recommendations. Consider legislation that will address 42 CFR regulations in a manner to assist in the sharing of information between key partners involved in drug and alcohol abuse treatment and prevention. Providing information to agencies with shared clients will ensure that everyone is acting on the most up-to-date information and making informed decisions. This would maximize the efforts of the multiple agencies providing services to an individual client. The second recommendation is to provide federal funding opportunities for the purchase of FDA-approved medications for the maintenance treatment of opioid use disorders. This would be in conjunction with comprehensive psychosocial services. Also, at the state level, the County of Orange submitted a proposal for SB 665, a state bill sponsored to allow for Mental Health Services Act, MHSA, funds to be used inside jails for mental health treatment for those who are severely and persistently mentally ill. However, there is no allocated sources of state and federal funding for substance use treatment. The U.S. Department of Justice recently released an announcement for the Residential Substance Abuse Treatment for State Prisoners Program. However, only state entities can apply to this grant despite its stated intent for it to be also an impact for local jails. My last recommendation would be to continue the fidelity of MHSA's Whatever It Takes model for recovery and integrated care. We continue to seek additional flexibility to integrate MHSA funding for substance use disorder services, including prevention and outreach efforts. Substance use disorders are widely classified as a mental health illness, and the Journal of American Medical Association estimates that roughly 50% of individuals with seriously mentally ill are living with substance abuse disorders. Additional flexibility will reduce rigid funding barriers and bolster counties' ability to make progress on new accountability metrics by allowing counties to be more comprehensive and serve the more critical and complicated populations with MHSA fundings. Lastly, with the assistance and guidance from this commission, I'm confident that the issues surrounding the impact of substance abuse on law enforcement will be addressed. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Chief DeLacy, for your testimony. Now we'll once again open up to commissioners for questions for Mr. Stewart and Chief DeLacy. Same as before, with commissioners with questions, please state your name prior to your question and direct the question to the specific panelist you have a question for, or if it's for both, please state so. Just as a reminder to the commissioners, your mics are hot at all times, and if you are going to ask a question, hit *6 to unmute your phone. Thank you, and commissioners with questions for our panelists.
Hi, it's Katie. Can you hear me?
Yes, Commissioner, we can hear you.
Okay, great. Hey, U.S. Attorney Stewart. Quite impressive. Yeah, and I've heard you speak so passionately about this issue before. And so I'm so glad that we got to hear from you. You did give us a long list of things. Be bold is one that'll be a little hard to translate, but out of everything that you've seen, I mean, to the president, but, like, everything that you've seen, what do you think is, if you had to prioritize, give me your top three, like, direct actions that we can take
I mean, I know I've driven through West Virginia, as you know, to come visit you, and, you know, it's apocalyptic what happened in your state. But it isn't just your state. Montana is getting killed with meth, along with other areas of the country, and then it looks completely different in urban communities, but just as devastating. So what are the top three recommendations, like direct deliverables, that you would recommend?
Okay, so my number one, and I say, I've been saying this since even before I got here, and being in this role and being in our community and seeing things firsthand, speaking with moms and dads, embracing moms and dads, we must destroy the cartels. And I know I saw a press conference last night in which it looks like we're going to be investing more time and money in using the Department of Defense to destroy the cartels. It must happen. And when I talk about micro versus macro, I appreciate the micro approach, the need for us to be individualized in terms of how we address this crisis. But when you look at the numbers of folks who suffer from this, there's no aspect of our society that's been left untouched by this crisis. It is a true attack on the culture and social fabric of this nation. A place like West Virginia, it will be decades of recovery to the degree we're able to. There are places in West Virginia that are, especially south of where I'm at, southern West Virginia, there are towns and communities that are barely left there at this point. And seldom is there a family that hasn't been impacted. Two, we have true problems with recruitment. That's where the idea of this GI Bill, for lack of a better term, just because I think people understand what I mean by a GI Bill for law enforcement, they truly are our domestic military. And I know, folks, that may make them uncomfortable, but the fact of the matter is we would have a very tough time functioning in this country without the men and women of law enforcement at the state and local level in particular, because 85% of all law enforcement is state and local. It's not federal. And we need to be thinking big in terms of providing support and benefits, whether that's educational benefits, whether it's child care benefits, whether it's tax benefits. We need to make this more attractive to inspire folks to law enforcement. And frankly, here in West Virginia, we have trouble getting folks to pass the background check and the drug check to become a member of law enforcement. And so those are the top two. But I do think hope is one of the most important things I can do when I'm out there speaking with folks in communities. We have to give hope, because these folks who are young, 16, 15, 17, that made the mistake of going down the path of being getting involved in the drug trade, and it leads from one direction to the next. We need to provide redemption and second chances for those folks. And we need those folks in law enforcement. I think there can be a real pathway there. Granted, folks with continuing problems, we can't afford to have in those positions. But we definitely need to make sure that we've got pathways. And then just fourth, I know you asked for three, but I think that point of punishment and accountability is real important. And I hear a lot of discussion today about social justice and bail reform. You know, here in West Virginia, at the state level, literally, we get personal recognizance bonds. I'll give you an example. We had a gentleman who was taken down with 48 pounds of methamphetamine, 48 pounds, street value, $2 million. And he was put into the state system and released on a $1,500 bond, which cost him $300. Now, in commercial terms, that's a pretty good deal, $2 million for $300. He left there, went to his home, got his dog, tried to get his possessions, was hitting the road till I realized he was let out. And I made some calls. We got him before he hit the border. But we need to make sure that we're the revolving door of quickly allowing drug dealers, not those folks addicted to substances, because I think that's a different issue. But the idea of the revolving door of the dealer, of the poison peddler, that has to stop. And it's demoralizing to law enforcement, who work so hard on an investigation, for those folks to quickly go back out on the street. And it's dangerous for our citizens. Did that answer it?
Commissioner Selma?
I put her to sleep.
No, she's there. She's kind of like me working with her mute button. Well, Mr. Stewart, I can tell you the point of personal privilege as the chair. I'm 71 years old, and I've been in law enforcement for 50 years, but I'm going to sign up for another tour and come to West Virginia.
Hey, we'd love to have you here, and I tell you, there's great respect for law enforcement here. One of the great challenges we have across the country right now, you know, on a side note, and I know everybody's busy, but I had a champion, the Back the Blue license plate here in West Virginia, and the legislature passed it last year. My license plate on my Ford F-150 is Back the Blue license plate 001. There is great respect for law enforcement here, but I think there's great appreciation in West Virginia that we're not going to win the battle of substance abuse on a micro level. It's important, but there needs to be a macro approach to this. We can't sustain the numbers that we have. We're moving the chairs around on the ship deck, and we have other things to do in law enforcement than just prosecute substance abuse. And an old timer who used to be an HSA a number of years ago called here, in fact, back in the 70s. And the number of AUSA is far smaller. And he actually told me, the final years in AUSA, they didn't prosecute a single substance abuse case, not one. And so everything's transformed. We need to get back to the point that there are other laws that we prosecute, other crimes that we prosecute. But I know you didn't ask me a question, but I gave you an answer to the question you didn't ask. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Stewart. Other commissioners with questions?
Mr. Chair, this is Nancy, and I have a question.
Yes, Commissioner Parr.
This is for Mr. Stewart. I would like to thank my local U.S. Attorney's Office. I am in Chesapeake, Virginia, so mine is the Eastern District of Virginia, for their level of cooperation with my city on drug investigations. One of the things, especially in Virginia, that we have looked for our U.S. Attorney's offices for a lot of help, and I'm saying this because I would like to see this expanded or maybe more cooperation throughout the country, is under our laws in Virginia, it is very, very difficult for us to prosecute the dealers for deaths resulting from their drugs. We've tried to get our General Assembly to change it 4 years in a row, and they've killed it each year. So we really rely on our U.S. attorneys to take those cases for us, and I think that is a very important area and one type of cases that I think the U.S. attorneys' offices would play a great role in helping local law enforcement and prosecutors on. The other thing is I'm really intrigued by this involuntary treatment aspect that you mentioned, and because for a couple of years I have had great concern about the increased availability of Narcan. I want to save as many lives as we can possibly save, but when it has been increased for almost anybody to be able to get Narcan, then there is no, in my isolated world, there's no incentive for people who are overdosing at home or with their friends if their loved ones and their friends have the Narcan and just are going to revive them for that day, because they're just going to, it's just going to be this ever-ending cycle. And I know we heard in Miami the impact of law enforcement having to go back 3 or 4 times and reviving the same person. I've heard from reliable sources that there are dealers who, when they sell the heroin, they're selling the Narcan along with it. And I have had conversations with recovering addicts who say that if they hear that somebody has overdosed or has died from a certain dealer's heroin, it's more attractive to them, because to them that means it's even a bigger high. So this involuntary treatment is very intriguing to me. Can you, any thoughts on the increased availability of the Narcan and no responsibility for calling 911 or anything?
So the only thing I'll add on this, the idea of involuntary treatment came from a mom, Stacey Archer, who lost her son Joel to a drug addiction, and she got that fateful knock at her door. And Narcan, it's great availability, so our decrease in overdoses being down 40%, we don't know how much Narcan contributes to that, so it's going to be difficult for us for a period of time to be able to figure out what these numbers are, but I agree with you. We get the same reports, which is the dealer with the potent drug, his sales or her sales go up as a result of taking folks right to the edge. And, we have first responders who will be at the same place two, three, four times in a day or a 24-hour period. But the involuntary commitment side, the only reason I came up with the 18 to 26-year time frame is I think most kids are eligible to stay on their parents' insurance to the age of 26, I think. And I wanted to tie it to something logical. Because if you're on your parents' insurance and you're addicted to drugs, it seems to me a necessary medical procedure that you're going to need is health and treatment. And those are the key years there. So I'd love to see us build this out into a good proposal. I haven't done it. I just think it makes a whole lot of common sense. Then on your first point, we work closely with Steve Williams, the mayor of Huntington, and it really has been a great partnership down there. But we take every overdose case leading to death that we can get our hands on, because what we're finding is at the local level, they're not taking these cases. I mean, they're very time consuming. The challenge we have is the opinion that we need from our forensic examiners, our medical professionals, of the but-for opinion. Often we end up with a most likely opinion. But what we've done in the case of another young lady, Victoria Douglas, and I carry pictures of all these kids, Victoria Douglas, succumbed to an overdose. Her parents didn't even know she was a drug user. And they went in that fateful morning and saw that foam dome over her face, and it's horrific. But what we did was, because we could only get a most likely opinion, we sought an upward departure of the sentencing guidelines at sentencing. And we put on our case in chief at sentencing, and we received the upward departure. There must be some accountability for the dealers to understand that what they think they're dealing, in this case, he thought he was dealing heroin, which is bad enough, happened to be fentanyl. But the idea that I think we need to be careful that we're not making it so easy for folks to evade prosecution, to evade accountability, that we're in some way inspiring the use of these substances. And like I said, that's not a DOJ opinion. That's my opinion based on my experience with the moms and dads and seeing the victims. But your points are well made. We take every case we can get. And we got a real challenge at the state and county level because of the resources it takes to prosecute these cases. There's such a volume of overdose that, frankly, state and locals, they sort of take it for granted. They move a victim and they move on to the next victim. But there has to be accountability for these drug dealers.
Thank you.
Commissioner Roush.
Yes.
Hey, so just a couple things. One is I work with the U.S. Attorney there on the Appalachia High Executive Board, and he's extremely genuine and passionate, and we appreciate him. I'm going to push back a little bit on Commissioner Parr, and much respect, obviously, but. In terms of Narcan, I think the availability of it is critical. And I would tell you that from being the parent of an addict and being deeply involved in when I was in my previous role as a chief in our community, dealing with families that were losing loved ones, I told our officers then, I don't care if we save the person 100 times. If we save the life, we save the life. The work then is trying to get them into recovery, and continuing to do that. So, I think the availability of Narcan is not our problem. I think that the problem is, and she hit it on the head with going after those people peddling the poison. That's the problem. We gotta go after those dealers. And Mike also mentioned that. We've got to go after the dealers. We've got to go after them, hold them accountable as effective as we can, and as frequent as we can. And that's got to be a key effort in this fight against drug dealing that we have into keeping our community safe. So I think we've got two tiers here that we're working with. One is go after those dealers, and two is provide that treatment for those addicts. And fighting on both of those fronts is the effort we've got to have. And I think that's key. I do have a question for the chief in terms of the challenges with 42 CFR. Can you expound on that a bit for us? I've heard that before from folks, and if you could help us understand a little more of what those challenges are, what roadblocks it's putting in place.
So I think the sheriff had touched on it a little bit and expressed that if the participant, the client, inmate, whoever the individual is, if they sign an authorization, then these entities can share information. But there's a lot of situations where we may not be able to get that authorization signed for a variety of different reasons. And then we also have a number of community partners that we're trying to engage more, because we can't just do it with our county and sheriffs. It's just not working. We need to engage the community. So what we need, even if an example is we get our post-release community supervision folks out of prison, and they have a MAP program in custody, but we are still having issues just talking between our county folks to the CDCR and sharing that kind of information with regards to the inmates that are coming out of custody, because the goal is to obviously do reentry, have that warm handoff, and be able to continue whatever treatment they have in place. So CDCR has been doing a wonderful job working on that reentry piece, and we would like to be able to continue that in some of our other areas locally.
Thank you, Chief. Other questions from commissioners?
Hey, Phil, this is Don Washington. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir, Director, you're recognized.
Hi, Mike. Don Washington again. It's good to hear from you. You know, we met, I guess, several months ago, and I'd love to hear your passion and the clarity of thought, I think, in what you're suggesting as some recommendations for this commission. I have, I guess, two questions in two different areas. One, the recommendation that you have regarding total targeted destruction of drug cartels. The primary question there is, what is it that you think that we need to be doing more than what we're doing today? And is it a resource issue, or is it a different, you know, programming kind of issue that we need to revise in order to achieve total targeted destruction of drug cartels? So that's on the one, that's on the one side of the equation. On the other side, I wonder if you have any thoughts as to what is the bigger carrot rather than the stick. What is the bigger carrot on the supply, or correction, on the demand side of the equation? What can we do or say or what steps can we take to address the demand side in order to, you know, kind of reduce that? Because I think we can beef up law enforcement and go after them pretty vigorously. I know when I was a U.S. attorney, you know, we created DPOTs and RPOTs and all of that, and it's still in existence today. And I'm just wondering if the Department of Justice has, you know, any kind of larger over the horizon thoughts about what we can do on the supply, on the demand side, that's sort of beyond, far beyond the, you remember the old Nancy Reagan Just Say No program of yesterday. So those two areas, if you could address them, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, and I'll do it briefly. And in particular, you asked me a question that can get me in a lot of trouble from the standpoint of my view on taking on the cartels. But I do believe, from the depths of my heart. When you see what's happened in this state, when you see the attack on the social fabric of this country, when you see the impact of this nation, I think last count, on an annual basis, measuring conservatively, it's more than $500 billion a year is spent dealing with the havoc caused by these cartels. I believe, and I'm comfortable in saying this, that the people of West Virginia would embrace and champion the idea of taking these cartels on their own turf. And we have the greatest intelligence services in the history of mankind in this country. But we're under the greatest assault in the history of our country by these cartels. They are enemies to this country. I think they should be treated, this is just me saying this, but I think they should be treated as enemy combatants, very similar to how we treated the folks in the war against terror. Because I don't think that the justice system, it's very difficult with the justice system and the protection that we afford and the difficulties that we have to spend in terms of prosecution. It's very difficult when you're really in a war, and this could be called nothing other than a war. In fact, in all of Vietnam, I think the numbers were about 58,220, if I remember the numbers right, that died during the entirety of the Vietnam War that were American citizens. We're talking about in 1 year of drug overdose alone, and not including those who get addicted, the challenges to families, murder, all those other issues. We're talking in 1 year in this country, we exceed the number of deaths from Vietnam. That has to be a very sobering thought. I know we can solve this thing, but we got to do it by taking on the cartels where they're at and destroying the foundation of what they're producing. And so I've got a lot of ideas on this, but I just believe that moving the chairs around and trying to reduce drug overdose by 5% a year, 6% a year, 10% a year, it doesn't get us where we have to go. And it's unfair for us to do this to future generations. Second, on the supply versus demand issue, I know there's a lot of debate on this whole issue. And supply, I think, has to be decimated to the degree we can. When I was first early in my life, I had some time in retail. And there was an old retail term that was stack it high, watch it fly. And I tested it many times, whether it's Reese cups or drugs or pizza. The higher you stack the pile, the quicker the stuff sells. And we have to take on the supply. But I agree that we also need to be focused on demand. It can't be one or the other. But there's no replacement for good jobs and a strong economy. That's the great challenge of COVID, is we've shut down an economy. And all those folks who are on the precipice of treatment and trying to get help and get through the greatest fight of their lives are now going to be in place. They're now placed in a position of the most, perhaps one of the great anxieties of their life, in which we're going to find, after the end of this crisis, a number of folks who were in treatment going back, and drug dealers will take advantage of it. But the other point I just want to make is the mixed messages we have in society. I've been one of the more outspoken U.S. attorneys. My personal view is that we need to be careful about legalization of marijuana. I think there are a lot of mixed messages out there. I do believe it's a gateway drug, and I know I get in trouble from the pro-pot folks when I say it. But the evidence I see, the cases that I see, the moms and dads I talk to says that marijuana is a gateway to the next drug. And I think we need to be careful about the legalization. We've waited decades on this. We need science and research to drive our decision-making. We shouldn't be driven by pure economics and tax revenues. It's a danger for us, and we need to be careful about it. But I think the mixed messages and the jobs front are the two best places for us to attack demand. And clearly, prevention, early, as these kids are in second grade and third grade. By the time they get to high school, it's too late. But this is talking from a guy who's not really an expert on anything. I'm just giving you my opinions from the things I've seen.
Thank you much.
Other commissioners.
This is Chris Evans.
Commissioner Evans, you're recognized.
First of all, I want to thank both the panelists. I'm one of the few people who probably have had the privilege of being in working with the districts of both of the panelists, so I want to thank both of them for that effort. And just following up with Commissioner Washington's comments or questions to U.S. Attorney Stewart, I would just ask that he submit. I know he, early on in his testimony, he talked about partnerships as it relates to demand reductions, and what I'd ask Mr. Stewart, is it possible for you to submit later some of the examples of those partnerships in regards to demand reductions. I've seen firsthand, I think, the diligence with which your office partners with law enforcement and the community to attack this issue. And I realize that you did not have the opportunity to put that in your statement, but I think it would be helpful for the committee if we could get some of those in a later on point of reference for your submission.
Absolutely, I'll do that, and I want to thank you in particular. That Operation Saigon Sunset was a DEA-driven event and significant for West Virginia, and the impact on Huntington cannot be understated or cannot be overstated. Quite significant, but I would love to lay out those partnerships because that's our real goal here is I want to make sure we're available and that we're the best partner any of these folks can get. I can't remember the last case I turned down. I probably need to get smart and turn a few down, but we take every case we can get our hands on because we want to make sure we're doing all we can for our partners out there. And it builds partnership by doing that.
Other commissioners with questions? Once again, other commissioners with questions. Thank you. Let me close by thanking our panelists once again for your time and most valuable testimony and certainly the responses to the questions from commissioners. On behalf of the Attorney General and his leadership staff, Rachel Bissick and Jeff Avila and all the commissioners, your contributions provided today are most sincerely appreciated and will assist the commission in their deliberations and work. Before we end the call today, just a reminder to the commissioners that we will next be focusing on the topic of reduction of crime. I want to thank you for your patience as we continue our migration to a virtual commission platform. The crime reduction panels will take place over the next 3 weeks. While next week's panels have been set, the federal staff is working on the subsequent panels' availability and lastly, testimony. I know all of you joined me in thanking our federal staff for undertaking this daunting task in this most uncertain and challenging time. Their patience and commitment is sincerely appreciated. We'll get you the testimony in advance for each call as soon as possible. The schedule is fluid, and we're asking subject matter experts to be available for us at the time they're managing this pandemic in their own respective ways. We certainly respect it, the burden that they have locally in dealing with the crisis we have today. We'll be sending out updates for the schedule via email and calendar invites as soon as possible. Again, we thank you for your flexibility as we navigate our new normal. Are there any comments or questions from community?